Hello and welcome to the Professional Horror Podcast, the one podcast you can't overlook. I am your host, Chris Donovan, and my guest this week is my good friend, Megan Pendergast. How are you doing, Megan?
I'm doing well. How are you, Chris?
I'm doing just fine. I just want to apologize to you guys. We haven't had an episode since Halloween time because I've gotten sick twice, and it's hard to schedule people around the holidays, but we're back this time. It's, you know, still the winter time, so it hasn't been 5 months like last year. This is our first episode over the interweb, so we're moving up in the world.
High tech.
Mm-hmm. Because Megan's coming to us all the way from, like, I don't know, some Connecticut places.
Yep.
I'm in the Rhode Island places, and yeah. I wanted to do a Christmas episode where I did Black Christmas and I sang Christmas carols for you guys, but now you don't get to hear my Christmas carols. So
maybe next year.
So since we have a new guest on the show, like we do whenever we have a new guest, we start off with a section called First Blood, where we get to know our guests. We know what lens we watch horror movies from. We're going to ask for your favorite horror movie, Megan, and your favorite sub-genre of horror movie. And just so everyone knows, even if this is your first episode, I'll throw mine out really quick.
Go ahead.
My favorite horror movie of all time is A Nightmare on Elm Street, the 1984 Wes Craven film. And my favorite sub-genre are slashers and creature features.
Nice.
So, Megan, whichever one you want to start with, go right ahead.
Okay, great. Well, I'm going to cheat on both of them. So that
Womp.
Because I was thinking about this. And I'm like, oh, how could I possibly pick? So then I'm like, oh, good news. I'm not going to. I'm just kidding. It's like, and I guess I can go back and forth from subgenre to favorite movie. Plural. Yep. But the subgenre is, I really like psychological horror in something like Silence of the Lambs, and which is one of my all-time favorite horror movies. But then I also really like, I don't know if you, I guess, kind of like satirical horror, like the recent movie Get Out, even like the Alien franchise, or like Cabin in the Woods. Like Cabin in the Woods and Alien aren't like my top three, but they're definitely like top 10. And then also The Thing.
Thing is the one movie, like, I will always try to convince people to watch horror movies. The Thing is the one where I'm like, only when you're ready.
Mm-hmm.
Only when you're ready, because the effects in that movie are horrifying.
I'm almost rendered stupid by my long to explain myself. But The Thing is so good because, and I really appreciate, actually, I think all the movies I said, there's no like romantic bullshit. There's no stupid storyline where people are dying all around each other, and yet still like these two like unrealistically good looking people are making eyes at each other and like wasting precious screen time, like banging in the woods or whatever. And then like, oh, and then they're the only ones who survive, even though by all logic, they should be the ones who die because they're the ones who keep getting distracted. And in The Thing, there's not even any women.
Yeah.
It's all men. And also, you never, even at the end, there's still remaining questions. You don't know exactly who's infected. Sometimes people die and you're not, and then you don't know how long people were infected. Mm. That movie's a triumph in the sense that it really builds dread and atmosphere.
Yes.
And it also somehow makes you care about the characters, even though they're dropping very quickly, which I think is masterful. Similarly, I love Silence of the Lambs, because honestly, who doesn't? That's one of the few films that's been nominated for Best Actor, Best Actress, Best Screenplay, Best Director, and Best Film.
I think it's the only horror movie to ever be nominated for Best Picture. I forget if it won. I think it did.
I think it won all five of those.
Yeah. It's the only horror movie. Like, horror movies have gotten nominated for some awards, like Kathy Bates in Misery got nominated, which, of course, that was incredible. Mm-hmm. But it's the only movie.
Performance was great.
I love that movie so much. Mm-hmm. But I think Silence of the Lambs is the only one to ever win Best Picture that's NBA quote-unquote horror movie.
I think you're right. I think that checks out. I can fact check it later, but I think you're definitely right.
Yeah.
And I think that also is interesting because that it's mostly from a female perspective, but they don't go the cliched route. Again, she doesn't have a love interest later in the books and in the inferior sequels. They kind of try to, you know, force a kind of love connection with her and Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah.
But in that movie and in the first book, it's just essentially like the cat and mouse game, and the psychological horror of what Buffalo Bill is doing. And then also from the perspective of a young FBI agent, not only trying to come into her own as an agent, but also to be taken seriously as a woman. And also these women who are literally being dismembered and taken apart so that the serial killer can take their femaleness. So it's the completely different take on femininity and women in the sense that their power is constantly being trying to be taken from them. And especially to have been written by Thomas Harris. I think that was a real triumph for the time as well. Like, at the time he wrote that, it was not a popular storyline.
Talking about the Hannibal sequels, I feel like it's not a surprise the only other one that I think is any good is Red Dragon, which also kind of drops that, and it's just another cat and mouse game, but from a different angle where it's like Hannibal's not trying to get into the mind of the detective. He's trying to like mess with him.
Yeah, he just like he's bored behind bars, essentially, and he wants to
So
ruin his life.
I would definitely
Lexi
agree. You know
Pit.
what's funny too is you said you wouldn't say in your top three. My top three favorite movies of all time are Aliens, Nightmare on Elm Street, Cabin in the Woods.
No
Love
way. They're definitely top 10 because I could talk forever, so I won't. But
it.
like Alien and Aliens, I think are just such a fascinating example of two, like Alien is obviously just the few crew, the alien, the mystery, the robot, and all that sort of thing, and the atmospheric, and then it's like, and then there was one, the countdown, everything. It's so isolating, and they just do an excellent job of that. And then Aliens is horror as well, but it's essentially an action film with a much bigger budget, with a much bigger cast. I mean, towards the end, obviously, not many survive, but it was two completely different takes in the same universe. I think that was fascinating.
Oh yeah, that's why I don't put Aliens. Whenever I say my favorite horror movie, I don't say Aliens, because I feel it's a sci-fi action movie first with horror elements, as opposed to a straight up horror movie like Elm Street. But I think it's just that is so fascinating because Alien is like the pinnacle of like suspense horror. It's such a beautifully like crafted like horror thriller type, and then you have one where it's just they just crank the action up to 100 in Aliens, and
It
it's
is.
just it's the most it's also like the most quotable movie I think of all time. It's
Oh
so fun.
yeah. Game over, man.
Game over, man.
Randomly, one of my favorite scenes in that movie is towards the end when Ripley is going down the elevator to get Newt. And then I think that's just such a good moment of acting too, because she's like leaning against it and she's arming herself, but she's also like mentally arming herself. Usually movies skip over that stuff, like but it was very humanizing to see the main character. You can just see that like the severity of the situation is kind of coming down around her, and she's being practical and she knows what she has to do, but the chances of survival are really low. And it's just
I
great
actually
to see
think,
like to see a character actually internalizing all of that.
yeah, I actually think to go back to our earlier conversation, I think Aliens is one of the, Sigourney Weaver is one of the other characters in a horror type movie to be nominated for an award. I don't think she won an Oscar, but I do think she was nominated for
I think
Best
she's nominated. I think
Actress.
she's nominated for Aliens, I think.
And I also want to touch really quick on you talking about you don't like horror movies with, the romance crap where they're like making googly eyes. I remember there's a Stephen King tweet, which we're going to talk a lot about Stephen King in the next two episodes we do. But there's a
He's a
tweet he
master.
had where it was like, I have found that the best stories I have come across involve friendships being tested. And I've realized in the past like few years that it's so true. The movies that I really like latch onto now, the B story, the emotional B stories aren't romance because most of them are just so interchangeable. But the ones that really like latch on for me are the ones where it's like a family dynamic or a friend dynamic.
I agree. Fire Force Friends.
Like the Final Girls, which came out a few years ago, I adore to pieces. It's a mother daughter.
Oh, I saw that. I really liked it.
I really like that. The Monster, which came out in like 2016, it's another mother daughter relationship. The Ritual, which came out last Friday on Netflix, dating ourselves here, but it came out last Friday. It's about four male friends and their dynamic. There's a woman, but it's like at the very end, it's complicated. It's not a romance though. It's just about the friendship, and that movie was really good too. I really enjoyed that. It's
I
like
feel like those are
those,
deeper.
yeah, because all the romance stories, there's no nuance to a horror movie romance. It's just almost always first love. At the end they kiss. We met, we went through some stuff, and now we kissed, and it's going to be happily ever after. And it's like, okay,
Great.
that's great. Whereas when you get family and friends, it always has to dig a little bit deeper into a more different story than you've seen before.
And they don't have to rest. They're not resting on like the attractiveness laurels, like the oh, like someone's like changing their shirt and like oh, the charged looks and like the soft music and like the way it's just like so played out. And then you have Aliens. I think a pretty good understated. I don't even know if I call it a romance because it doesn't go anywhere. Is between her and Dwight. I think his name's Dwight, right? What's it, is that his real name? Or Dwayne?
Dwayne
What?
Hicks,
Dwayne
Corporal
Hicks. I
Dwayne
can't remember if it was Dwayne
Hicks.
or Dwight. Okay, Hicks. With her and Hicks, I think that's good because you can like tell that there's something under there. But realistically, there's a lot bigger problems than like getting in each other's pants. So it gets tabled
Yeah,
totally.
that's one of the most understated romantic subplots. It was just so understated that when I watched it as a kid, and I watched the VHS of Aliens like 100 times as a kid. It's one of the three movies I remember like watching when I was like 5 years old. It was like the first wave of a adult movies I saw. Like after like Barney and stuff, the first movies I remember watching are Halloween and the first two Alien movies. The first 100 times I saw Aliens, I didn't even pick up on it. Mm-hmm. Which granted, I was a little kid, but at the same time, for the first hour, it's just they occasionally have two shots back to back where they look at each other.
Yeah.
And then they have the, you know, it doesn't mean we're married or anything, with the tracker.
Yeah, yeah.
And he teaches her how to shoot, and that's it. It's so understated, but you can clearly see that connection that they have. And I love that movie to pieces.
It's no,
so
me too. Good. I think it's very well done.
Anywho, let's get to the subject at hand.
We're really good at getting off track.
Oh, man, this is like no one's here to reel us in at this point.
No, if Nicole was here, she would have sprayed us water bottles by now. Yep.
She'd have been like, okay, so someone's story. Like, anywho. So this episode, we're going to be talking about The Shining, the 1980 Stanley Kubrick, however you want to pronounce it. I don't know how to pronounce it.
I've never known.
Film that a lot of people, I know I see The Shining on a lot of lists of the greatest horror movies ever made. I know it's nowhere near Stephen King's top horror movie ever made. We'll talk to that because we're going to talk about the movie this episode, and you know, we're gonna have a little bonus thing afterwards where we talk about the book and the connections therein. So The Shining, for some background, has 8.4 out of 10 rating on IMDb.
Pretty good.
And pretty decent. 63% on Metacritic and 87% approval on Rotten Tomatoes.
Nice.
The Rotten Tomatoes consensus is, though it deviates from Stephen King's novel, Stanley Kubrick's The Shining is a chilling, often baroque journey into madness, exemplified by an unforgettable turn from Jack Nicholson.
It's unforgettable for sure.
Yeah. One thing I do want to talk about is, have you seen some of the other names thrown around to play Jack Torrance?
Yes.
Oh, some of them are fun.
Yeah, I think that one of the major ones is John Lithgow.
Yeah, John Lithgow was talked about.
I think it's also Robert De Niro, but I'm not 100%. I think Robert De Niro maybe too.
Yeah, I heard De Niro. The two most interesting that I heard was Christopher Reeves, who is Superman. I could 1000% see Stephen King for how his interpretation of Jack Torrance is, how Christopher Reeves fits that mold. Because Jack Nicholson going crazy, that's, you know, pick any of his movies. He was
already crazy when it started.
Yeah, pick any of his movies, you're probably going to find it. Mm-hmm. But Superman going crazy? Now that's a different ballpark. And the other one that I really loved is Robin Williams.
Oh, yeah, I heard about that.
Yeah. Kubrick thought De Niro was not psychotic enough for the role, and he thought that Robin Williams was too psychotic.
Given the fact that Robert De Niro just came off Taxi Driver, pretty amazing.
Yeah. He thought he wasn't psychotic enough after watching Taxi Driver.
I know, exactly. That's the crazy part.
Like, that's nuts.
And Robin Williams was only known for comedy, I think, at that point, like Mork and Mindy and his stand-up routines.
They also briefly considered Harrison Ford for Jack Torrance, which also I could see that fitting.
Makes sense.
What Stephen King would want.
From a Stephen King's perspective.
Yes.
He wanted like an ordinary man.
Yes, he wanted
descending to madness.
He
didn't want a crazy man getting crazier.
Yeah, he wanted an everyman who was clearly being turned crazy by the spirits in the Overlook Hotel and alcoholism, not someone like Jack Nicholson who was clearly crazy from Jump Street.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Which I can see.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's just the book and the movies just have completely different merits.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it's like, I could totally see that, and I would love to watch a version of The Shining with Christopher Reeves or Robin Williams or Harrison Ford in the lead, but I'm not sure I could trade it for Jack Nicholson's.
No.
It's so good.
So I was just reading an article that they were talking about how creator backlash thing, how both Jack Nicholson and Shelley Duvall were frustrated with how much credit Stanley Kubrick got for the creation of the movie and then not enough on their performances. And Jack Nicholson especially said of Shelley Duvall that she played one of the most difficult roles he's ever seen an actor play. And he felt that she was completely underrated, which as I get older, I agree with. When I was younger, she's just so strange seeming and also so mousy that you're kind of like off put, but she's a classic battered wife.
Yeah.
She's also
It's one of those things where it's like, I do have a lot of respect for Shelley Duvall because of, you don't have to read too far into the background of the film to know that she was like tortured on the set of that film.
He tortured her.
She said that she wouldn't trade the experience for the world, but she would never do it again. because of like the trauma and the isolation that she was put through, because Stanley Kubrick not only treated her like garbage, but also insisted that people like leave her alone in between takes and like not try and comfort her or anything to get the most out of her in that role. But one of the things I do think about the movie is watching Jack Nicholson and Shelley Duvall, I don't see how they ever would have been together in the first place. That's a big thing for me, where they seem like, it does seem like they were cast to be husband and wife, and that their characters would never become husband and wife.
I could see it only from the perspective of Stephen King's novel. I completely agree, because they're like an all-American couple. I think they're in their early 30s in the book. She's blonde. I'm pretty sure she used to be a cheerleader. She's actually like a pretty stereotypical, beautiful kind of housewife. And then he's also like handsome, kind of gruff, young, also all-American. But for the movie, they did an interesting take, which is that they're both a lot older, much older. I think it's intentional. The entire thing is so off-putting. They're much older and they have a young son, which is the opposite of what Hollywood usually does. Usually it takes a book with like not good-looking people and then makes them unrealistically good-looking, instead of taking a book with good-looking people and making them a lot gruffer looking, or and also aging them up. Like, that was a pretty bold move. It's not like a normal move. Again, usually people age them down or they make them more attractive, not less. And just the way that Jack Nicholson's character, well, the way Jack treats Wendy, and the way that Wendy is so, she's so frazzled. She's constantly smoking. She's constantly shaking. She really, it's clear she really only, she's focusing all her energy on her son. I think it's very clear that she's been emotionally and psychologically tormented by Jack for a very long time. And it's not the hotel that made it happen. It's their marriage.
It was Jack Nicholson and their marriage.
I mean, again, I'm completely guessing, and this is, they probably don't even put this thought into it, but from like the perspective of an abusive marriage, I could see them of being long, being together for a long time, and the power struggle that happens between a couple in that sort of extremis. And then the fact that they have a young kid so old seems also like a power struggle, maybe on Jack's part. Like, yeah, she's going to leave, she gets pregnant.
Yeah, I could. That's the only thing I could see about them being together. It's that they were different people when they were younger. And like in the book, how the alcoholism kind of drove Jack to a bad place, and then he had to pull himself back because he lost most of his opportunities. I could see that that already happened before they had Danny, and that was sort of like a, well, we're gonna separate, but what if we have a kid, we need to stay together kind of thing.
People do that in real life. It's sad, but it's true.
And in the movie,
that's really but you're right, they're like, they're not a couple that makes sense on paper, and it's not, at no point in the movie you're like, oh, like, that's why they're together. In the book, he shows her a lot more respect until he starts mentally deteriorating, and then he starts lashing out. In the movie, he's snapping at her and like subjugating her the entire time.
In the book, it feels more like a Stephen King Tabitha King relationship, where she's even like reviewing like what he writes and stuff. It feels more natural. And in the miniseries, they're played by Steven Weber and Rebecca De Mornay, who Rebecca De Mornay is
interesting.
She's gorgeous in that movie.
She's a beautiful woman.
She's beautiful, yeah. So like, there's a scene where the separation between the two of them is more jarring in the miniseries, and that's one of the biggest comments I can give the miniseries. Because there's a scene where there's a scene where Wendy in the miniseries is like, is that why you won't make love to me or whatever? And it's like, in the movie, those two probably weren't doing anything together. But in the miniseries, you're like, Steven, that's Rebecca De Mornay right there. What are you doing?
It's like, why aren't you on that all the time?
I don't know. She's like throwing herself at you. What are you doing? So it's one of the big differences between the movie and the book. So the movie starts out with Jack Torrance, played by Jack Nicholson, of course, arriving at the Overlook Hotel. Nice long driving scene, you know, get to see some gorgeous Colorado landscapes. I don't even think it was Colorado, actually. Could be wrong, though. It was St. Mary Lake next to Wild Goose Island in the opening scene. Where that is, don't know. It doesn't tell me where it is. It's just a picture on Wikipedia, folks. We're all human here.
I'm Googling it right now.
And that's where he meets Ullman, which another big difference from the book is Ullman is like the nicest dude. He's just like really cool with Jack Torrance. I'm going to keep saying them messed up all the time.
That's fine. They're both Jacks.
Where he's just like, you know, calling it like it is. He's like, yeah, you know, you'll be fine to run the Overlook Hotel. Don't worry about it. By the way, some people got hacked up here. Hope you don't mind. And
it's another, totally different in the book.
What I think is weird, too, is there's a scene, too, where Jack says to Ullman, he's like, my wife won't have a problem with that because she's a confirmed ghost story and horror movie addict. And that never gets brought up ever. She's never watching anything horror or reading anything horror. It almost seems like Jack's not even thinking about his wife. He's just saying things to make Ullman
to make feel this better. Job.
Yeah, because that's a thing about, you know, me, as far as me watching movies. If she was a confirmed ghost story and horror movie addict, I would like her a lot more as a character. I'm not a complicated man. Yeah, but this is what we learn, is that Jack has to do some, he has to take care of the hotel, yada yada yada, keep it warm. It's built on a Native American burial ground, of course, and it
naturally.
And we learn about Charles Grady, who this is the first time we hear Charles Grady, which strangely enough, when he later on in the movie, he becomes Delbert Grady. I think it's in that way in the book too, isn't it?
I think it's always Delbert, but I could be wrong. I think that it's
in the movie, it's he clearly says Charles Grady, and then he's Delbert later on, where Charles Grady basically got cabin fever and killed his wife and two kids, 8 and 10 years old, with an axe, and then shot himself with a shotgun. And he's like, all right, hope you don't mind that that happened in this hotel. And Jack's like, I mean, I guess I kind of need this job. So
yeah. That was kind of a last-ditch effort for Jack Boy over there.
One thing in the book, we really go through what Jack is writing. In the movie, he's very ambiguously writing. He's just working on a project. We don't get a lot of information from him on that. So they drive up. He gets the job, but Danny already knows that because he's got The Shining, which, for those who don't know, which if you've gotten this far and you don't know anything about The Shining, kudos. Thank you. I appreciate you as a person. The Shining is a telepathic power where you can communicate with other people with The Shining. You can read thoughts. You can know the future. It's basically, it kind of does whatever the plot demands, basically.
Yep, essentially. I like the term The Shining because it makes sense in the sense that, like, they're just, these people are just kind of glowing. So when Danny meets Dick, it makes sense they'd identify each other because they can identify that. And see with all
the ideas. Yeah, it's kind of like the whole concept of like auras or whatever, where that person has a brighter aura because they're shining.
Exactly. It's like figurative but also literal, which I like when things like that. And I think you also mentioned Wives' Tale, where if a baby's born with a caul on their face, which is like that gross milky white thing, they'll essentially be more in tune, that they're like, they'll have like prophetic powers. So then the idea is that they do actually explicitly say that Danny was born with that.
Yeah.
So like there's the idea that it's tied to that.
In the book, The Shining, and also much deeperly explained in the sequel book, Dr. Sleep, basically, like, you get The Shining with like a clout thing on your face if you're born with it, and it also is mildly hereditary. There's a film theory, which film theory is really great, I enjoy film theory, that all the kids in It have The Shining. He theorizes that you develop The Shining as sort of like a response to abuse, I guess, as like as like a defense mechanism, which that makes sense, because I do think all the most of the kids in It, most of the Losers Club, feel like they do have The Shining, particularly in the book, or at least some level of shine to them.
Weirdly enough, the one I would say probably has the most is Stan.
Stan has, because
he's the only one who left and remembers.
Yeah,
and he's the only one who makes reference to his time as a kid. The rest of them forgot, except for Mike.
Spoiler alert: if you've only seen chapter one of It and not the miniseries or the book, Stan, he remembers stuff from their childhood and isn't exactly keen to return to Derry. Let's just say that.
Not keen
at all. Yeah, I do think they all have a level of shine to them, but it's unfortunately, I don't think that theory stands up as far as developing it as a result of abuse, even though Danny and Dick were both abused.
Yep, they were.
So, who knows? But then again, so was Jack. But also in the sequel, Dr. Sleep, maybe Jack has the shine. I don't know. It's complicated.
Well, it could be like anything else where people might have a natural talent, but if they don't hone it, they're not going to develop it.
Maybe.
If you're predisposed towards something and you never take the time to like sharpen it, then you might have that natural ability, but if you're not using it, it's not going to get used.
Yeah. But what we learn through Dick Halloran, the chef of the Overlook Hotel, is that not only is Danny Torrance, we don't actually get this much in the movie, but he shines like more than most people do.
Yes.
When I rewatched the movie the other day, I was surprised that it wasn't stated fully that the reason why the stuff is happening at the Overlook is because Danny shines more than most people. And actually the movie takes a whole different direction in regards to why the hotel does what it does. It feels more like they're after Jack in the movie, and they're very clearly after Danny in the book.
It's interesting. Yeah, especially the movie takes a completely different approach.
Which I understand from the standpoint of there aren't a lot of 5-year-olds capable of acting to that ex to the extent where they can carry a movie.
Nope.
Granted, that's why I think there could be some merit to remaking The Shining now, because I don't know where we found all these kid actors who are fantastic, but we found them, so let's use them. It has like 8 good child actors.
Yeah,
I
none
don't
of
know
the
where
kid,
they pulled them out.
all of the kid actors in it, I think, are good at least, and some of them are great.
Like, if you remade The Shining with the kid who played Georgie as Danny, like, sign me up. That sounds great.
Oh yeah, that'd be great. That would be great. So
Yeah.
you're gonna be excited for this hypothetical project. And
The kid who plays Georgie is going to be in the pilot of Lock and Key, which is a Joe Hill production. Joe Hill is Stephen King's
cool.
son. And I went to his book signing of Joe Hill, and he talked about having like 3 kids from it in his pilot. And one of the funniest things he said is he's trying to work in a scene where like the kid who plays Georgie is like bugging his older brother. It's like, can we get ice cream? And he's like, yeah, fine, we'll get it like a root beer float. And then the kid's going to be like, yeah, float, 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 float. Which I was like, you're the best, Joe.
That would be very funny. I like how Joe Hill and Stephen King like are self-referential amongst each other. I think that's really cute.
Yeah, that's really fun. I really enjoy their like back and forth stuff.
Me too.
Anyway, I haven't even got
One
to
thing
the.
I have to say for the directors and producers who are definitely listening to this
Oh, yeah.
is whoever made The Shining, please make it in the 70s, make it 90 or early 80s.
Early 80s.
Don't make it now. Don't make it now. Because guess what? Especially if you're gonna be on, if you're going to be authentic to the book, the only reason that Wendy stays with Jack is because one, divorce is frowned upon. Two, she doesn't have a job. And three, she doesn't have a college degree, which she could still have a college degree in this day and age, but the reason she didn't get a college degree is because she met Jack and got married, which is what women did back then,
Yeah.
more often than not. Not all of them, but so this is something that works in terms of character. If you want to stay authentic to the book, it works as a period piece because that's a, thank God it's a bygone era, but it's a bygone era. A woman biding her time, leaving her husband because she literally can't support herself. It's like, again, that could happen now, but then you would have to make either Wendy more docile or less ambitious, or you'd have to make Jack more overbearing, like closer to the 1980 movie version.
Right. And Mike Flanagan, who's a director that I really, really love. I think he's done a lot of really great work with like Hush, Oculus, Gerald's Game.
I really like to take on Gerald's Game, and I really like Tosh.
I think he's fantastic. He's going to be adapting Dr. Sleep, the sequel to The Shining. So it would make sense if a Shining remake were to come out, takes place in the 80s, so that this one can take place in the current age. Because if you're going to remake The Shining and make it in current day, and then adapt,
Make it
obviously
in the
it's going to take
future.
place in like 2045, which who knows what's going to happen there
Who
if we're
knows?
even going to make it to that point.
God, I hope so.
I hope so.
I
Anywho, so
don't think
we're going to stay on
more.
target. We're going to talk about the movie at some point.
I think we talked about it some.
We've talked about it some, but I'm trying to go through the like event by event, and event by event
Event
we're
by
still
event,
at
sorry.
Jack and Danny's crazy premonition where the doctor has to show up. So Danny sees some crazy stuff. He sees blood coming out of an elevator door. He sees 2 girls who, despite what everyone says, are not twins.
They're not, they're just sisters.
They're 8 and 10 years old, as stated by Ullman. We learn about Danny's premonitions. We learn about his friend Tony, who lives in his mouth. Apparently, the finger and the voice he did himself, Danny
It's
Lloyd
pretty
did.
cool.
Yeah, it's pretty good. I would have thought that, you know, maybe they brought someone in, but no, that's one of the most fascinating things to me about this movie is apparently Danny Lloyd did not know it was a horror movie when he filmed it,
Nope, he didn't. He didn't even know
which
he was a teenager.
it makes me wonder how after watching it. There's a few scenes where I'm like, he probably should have known something was up. Maybe he just wasn't like the sharpest knife when he was 5.
I could see that they treated him like it was a family drama.
Yeah.
Most of the stuff he was in, like what was like intense scenes with his parents, or it was like him reacting to things. And then after he has like bruises on his neck, but he doesn't actually get strangled in the scene.
Right.
He just
It's
gets
one of
he
those
goes
things.
in, and then he like ah. So again, he's reacting to things, but he didn't really have any of the supernatural stuff happen directly to him where he would have had to act it out.
Which I do think is one of the reasons why the movie and the book are so different, is because of that reluctance to use the actor Danny Lloyd in any of those intensive scenes. Like in the book, any of the mini, like the one shining moment of the miniseries is the scene in room 217 with Danny. And that's a shining moment in the book too, because that's the first time they go from being just like pictures in a book to something more. But in the movie, since they didn't want to do that to Danny Lloyd, we get a different thing, which is also freaky, which we'll get to. But it's just, it makes, it changes the whole dynamic of the movie for sure. So, and we also learn in that scene with Wendy talking to the doctor about Jack dislocating Danny's shoulder after a drunken binge. I think it's a great scene for Shelley Duvall because she's saying it very calmly and almost like it's not a big deal, but you can just see like the cigarette just like burning away, and it's just a giant thing of ash on the end, and she's like, it's clearly like making her super anxious. She's not okay with this, but it's just like she's kind of stuck.
Yeah,
I thought it was a great scene. From there we go pretty much right to them going arriving on the hotel. One of the weird things about the movie is they always have these title cards of like later that day or next month and Tuesday, and there's no real anchor to any of those moments really. Like, it'll just say, like, Tuesday, and it's like, okay, what Tuesday? They're there the whole winter. There's going to be a lot of Tuesdays. Which one? So when they arrive, they finally meet the chef, Dick Halloran, who offers Danny ice cream telepathically, which that's fun. It's very different.
Telepathically or otherwise.
Yeah, it's very different in the book where he's just like, hey, help me load my car while I tell you about The Shining.
Which is actually kind of creepy if you think about it.
It is. It's kind of creepy. But in that those scenes in the movie, and I mean the book, the miniseries, Dick offers a lot more valuable information to Danny. In the movie, he just says like, The Shining exists and you've got it. This place is creepy. Later.
That's actually one of the things about the movie that I'm not crazy about is the interpretation of the Dick character. Especially,
I mean, Scatman Crothers we'll get there,
but I don't know. They changed his fate needlessly.
It's almost comical what they do to him.
It is. Have him built up as like coming to help them. I mean, he brings a vehicle, so he does ultimately help, but it's just like, I don't know. It's just foolish, I think.
He just becomes Groundskeeper Willie.
He's a really good character and he's wasted.
He just becomes Groundskeeper Willie from The Shining, which, by the way, you want to talk about adaptations of The Shining, the best one is The Shining. Let's get real, folks. That's the best adaptation.
But no, I totally agree. I feel like that was a huge wasted opportunity.
In the ice cream scene, it's just basically Danny saying, I mean, Dick saying, we have telepathic powers, both of us. It's called The Shining.
And get
Danny,
used to it.
Yeah, get used to it. And Danny presses him saying, hey, is there something to be afraid of in this hotel? And he's, what about room 237? And Dick's like, there ain't nothing in room 237. But he also tells him directly after that to stay away from 237. Which, fun fact, in the book and the miniseries, it's room 217. But the reason it's 237, apparently, in the movie, is the hotel that they were using interiors for. They thought if they used that room, 217, which was an actual like room that you can book, that attendance for that room would plummet. So they asked them to use 237, which was a room that doesn't exist. It was like a janitor's closet or something. And they said, okay, just use 237 because we can't lose business on 237. It doesn't exist. And in turn, what actually happened was 217 is now their most highly requested room to book. So, you know.
Opposite of what they thought.
People like spooky stuff, man.
Yeah, they do.
The waiting on the Stanley Hotel, which is where the Shining is based on, for 217 is apparently like 4 years.
Damn.
So after Dick and all them get settled and on their way, we enter the crux of the film, which is Danny, Wendy, and Jack just being in the Overlook Hotel and just kind of living their lives. You know, they go through the hedge maze. Danny rides his big wheel through the place. Jack is trying to write and can't write. The first real scene of tension happens was, again, a big departure from the book's version of Jack and Wendy, is when Wendy checks on Jack's writing and he tells her to get the fuck out of there. The scene
not
where
respectful partner.
Yeah, not respectful. That's the one of the bigger differences, because in the book it feels like Wendy's sort of like Tabitha King, where it's like, oh, I'll read your stuff and I'll edit it and I'll make it, you know, sound nicer, where Jack is just like, get away from me when I'm writing. And there's a big scene I read from my IMDb trivia facts that was in the script and filmed but was not put in there, was where Jack found the scrapbook in the boiler room full of the Overlook's deeds, all the stuff that's happened there, all, you know, like the gang members who the dirty deeds of the Overlook. And you can see in that scene when Wendy comes in, the scrapbook open next to his typewriter, but we never see him get that scrapbook, which in the book, that's a huge thing. That's a huge deal. The book, I mean, the scrapbook, and impacts the direction of the novel. Whereas in the movie, it's just like, I don't know where he got that. Who cares? And Stanley Kubrick's writing partner, actually, she's really sad that that scene did not get in there. She thought it was crucial to the direction of the film. Mm-hmm. But Stanley Kubrick disagreed.
As he's apt to do.
Yep. It's his way.
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously, they made that major change from the book to the movie with the animal hedges. That's climactic in the book. But they couldn't think of a way to do it, which wouldn't look silly, which I'm sure they're right. So they axed that all together.
Yes. In the book, they're topiary animals, which come to life. And in the movie, there is a hedge maze, which hedge maze is a really cool set piece. I will say, I listened to the Boys and Ghouls podcast. I mentioned them before on this podcast. They had an idea, which I did think was really cool, where Marshall, one of the two hosts, said, I'm sure if they went to Jim Henson's studio, he could have figured out a way to make topiary animals that moved in a cool way, which would have been cool.
It would have been.
In the miniseries, they're CGI, and it's awful.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely terrible. But
CGI, pretty much, at least so far, it never ages well.
No, especially mid-90s CGI.
Nope.
It's bad.
It's frightful stuff. Even a lot of the effects in Lord of the Rings hold up because it's miniatures. Yeah. And things like that. They're not using CGI. They use some CGI, but like most of they use practical effects, which are smarter.
CGI is so unreliable. Like the effects in Jurassic Park look better than the effects in Jurassic World, which that makes no sense.
But that's because they were mostly animatronics in Jurassic Park.
It was like 60-40 animatronics to CGI. But the scenes that are clear CGI are still better than Jurassic World, and that makes no sense.
I think they were smarter about it and they took more time.
Yeah, and I also think that they had the CGI do less.
Yes.
Like there's the scene in Jurassic World at the very end where it's like a 5-minute fight scene, which granted is the best scene in that movie by far. But they didn't have a 5-minute scene of straight CGI in Jurassic Park. They just came in for a burst and then left.
Because Jurassic Park was a much better story. Mm-hmm. So they relied on the actual story rather than throwing special effects at you until the point you're like rolling your eyes. Jurassic Park has suspense. Jurassic World doesn't. It's a barrage.
What I will say about Jurassic World is it is the greatest sci-fi original movie of all time. That's how to describe Jurassic World. It's the best.
Also the highest budget, original. I would imagine.
Also the highest budgeted sci-fi original movie. But it's got all the trimmings. It's got, you know, the government wanting to use the monsters
for
battle. It's got, you know, the paper thin romance, the so opposite characters, and just monster death upon monster death. Death for no reason. Yep. It's a sci-fi original movie.
It is.
Anyway, that's a different podcast episode.
I know. I could rant about that too. So Jurassic Park's one of my favorite movies.
The ending of that movie is the only reason why to watch it. Don't even watch Jurassic World, guys. Just watch the end fight scene on YouTube.
Yep.
It's great.
Same with, I mean, this movie's a lot less regaled and a lot less recent. So the movie Constantine, pretty much garbage, but the end is pretty dope. And their interpretation of the devil is one of the best devil interpretations I've ever seen in this film.
Yeah.
Which is amazing. Peter Stormare kills it.
Peter Stormare is fantastic.
You wouldn't expect it from Constantine, this supremely mediocre movie, to have the best devil. But honestly, I think it does. I think he's better than... I'd have to think hard to think of a better one. I think he's better than Al Pacino, which I know, perhaps... might be sacrilege, but
is it better than Bedazzled, though? Or no, Bedeviled?
Elizabeth Hurley is obviously supreme.
Yes, Elizabeth Hurley.
I recant everything I just said.
Oh, man. That was one of the quickest redactions I've ever seen.
Yeah, the best. And also Elizabeth Hurley in the Brendan Fraser vehicle.
What a crazy movie. So The Shining. I think.
Shining.
The hedge mange, I do think, is it's really fun as a stand-in for the topiary animals. And also, there's a lot more, I don't know, symbolism, I guess you can do with a hedge maze.
They had a smart way of having Danny outsmart his dad in that, too, with retracing footsteps.
I really like that. It's one of those scenes where at first you're like, what is he doing? Mm-hmm. And then you're like, oh, I get it. He's making it look like his footsteps ran out, which is another scene where I wonder how Danny Lloyd thought it was not a horror movie. He's running away from his father in a hedge maze in the snow, and his dad runs past him like screaming with an axe in his hand, and he's like, okay, this is a family drama.
Oh, yep. This is just this happens every Christmas.
Oh, man. Anywho. Room 237, let's talk about that really quick, because 237 is like the room with the most activity in the book, for sure. And it's one of the main ones in the movie, too. We just see Danny like drive past it on his big wheel like two or three times and then suddenly the key is in there at one point. And then we see him go in, but we don't see what happens in there.
Nope.
And then we get Jack go in there for one of the all-time greatest boner-killing scenes of all time.
Oh, yeah. The doozy.
Where, That's top. That's top three at least.
Jack Nicholson goes in. Stanley Kubrick's boner killing scene. Like, how many boners does that man kill?
I don't know. A lot with that scene. I don't know how many. I'm not that familiar with all of Kubrick's work, but I don't know how many other top tier boner killing scenes he has. When he walks into room 237 and there's a gorgeous woman in the bathtub who comes out, she's naked, and Jack decides to make out with her because that's what you do when you find
a strange
naked woman in a hotel where there's not supposed to be anyone else. Mm-hmm. And then she becomes a melty, decayed older woman in a flash, and it's just, you can't see the face I just made, guys listening to this podcast, but it was a skeeved out face.
Mm.
It was just
And she does some kind of like crazy cackle laugh too.
Yeah, she just laughs until he's like locked the door and ran down the hallway, and then he goes to the apartment. And Jack's like, and when he's like, "Did you see anyone?" He's like, "No, didn't see anyone." He's crazy. I'm like, "What?" That's the weirdest scene for me, I think, in the whole movie. That whole sequence of events. Because in the movie, I don't even feel like that person is like a specific ghost.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it's like a trick of the room, whereas she's like a full character in the book. I feel like everything we're saying is just like every sentence we're just going, well, in the book, well, in the book.
In the book. I know. I'm a total butt in the book dick. Like always. Like I was the only one who finished it. Well, I made a few different groups go see it, and like at the end, yeah, they're like, well, then I'm like, well, in the book this, well, in the book that.
I said, I had a conversation like that when I left.
You should read the book.
It was literally like where someone's like, oh, and this happened, and I'm like, well, it's weird, you know, because in the book this happened. I'm like trying to stop myself from being a by the book dick, as you put it, because to adapt the book like word for word, it would take forever.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell a quick story about that. There's a silent movie that I saw at film school called Greed. The director wanted to make the book word for word. He ended up making it. Every time he got a new cut, they would tell him, okay, you need to cut it back. You need to cut it back. You need to cut it back. And originally, it ended up being like 10 hours long.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a very long book, if I remember correctly. It's only like 500 pages or so. Mm-hmm. But it was 10 hours. And then he cut it down to 8 hours. And he cut it down to 4 hours. And he cut it down to 2 hours. And finally, they went at 2.5 hours. Like, okay, we can release this. And it's the most boring movie I've ever seen in my life. I could not physically imagine sitting through 10 hours of that movie. It's like all those people are like, I want to see the book exactly as it is. I'm like, I don't want to go to the movies for 7 hours.
No. I think adapting a novel into a movie is incredibly difficult, especially a novel that takes place mostly in someone's head.
Yes. Because
I think that more often than not, voiceovers don't work. I'm looking at you, Blade Runner. I know it's classic, but no. Even like self-deprecating voiceovers, I cringe at too. Sometimes they're okay. I get easily irked by stuff like that. But it's like most novels, obviously, can be very interior for mm-hmm. the characters. You're in their heads more than in their actions, or more than, and you know, you hear them talk, but you know how often right. someone talks and is thinking something different. So I think that's a huge challenge. And one book I think is better as a movie than as a book is Misery. Better movie.
Yes,
than
I think Misery. I love the book, but I think the movie is just absolutely classic. Yeah. Might be my favorite Stephen King adaptation.
That's a solid. It's definitely in the running. And Kathy Bates's take on the Annie Wilkes character, it's a lot more interesting than mm-hmm. the character in the book, because the character in the book, as soon as you're introduced to her, you can tell she's crazy. There's no ambiguity. The Kathy Bates character, it takes a little while. There's a little bit like gaslighting. Obviously, you know, because you're watching the movie, that she's going to be crazy, but mm-hmm. you're kind of like, oh, am I taking this out of context? Is he being paranoid? Like, and he's a dick. So you're like a little on her side sometimes, where you're like, oh, come on. Like, she took you in and you're being really ungrateful. So it's like, I think that interplay was really important.
Oh, yeah. That's such a fantastic one of mm-hmm. my favorite Stephen King adaptations. That I feel like in Christine might be my two favorites.
Christine's great too.
But what I was going to say is I feel like for that reason you mentioned about being in the head, I feel like The Shining might be harder to adapt than even It, because it's mm-hmm. long. It has a lot happening, but It constantly has at least 3 or 4 characters on screen talking.
Yeah. A lot of dialogue.
Constantly has the Losers Club talking to them. Whereas The Shining, you'll go full sections where it's just Jack Torrance saying, I need a drink, I need a drink, I need a drink, I need a drink.
Mm-hmm.
You don't really get that in the movie. You get the one scene where he's at the bar and he's like, I'd sell my soul for just a glass of beer. In the book, by that point, we've known how badly Jack needs a drink.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, you can't get that across in a movie as well.
No.
Without someone to bounce off of or voice over. And those aren't as fun.
No. That's what, again, another great thing about The Shining, the film is a movie that can portray realistic is kind of a hard sell because Stanley Kubrick isn't necessarily realistic, but it's intentional, it's stylistic. Mm-hmm. But like a quote unquote realistic descent into madness, mm-hmm. I think is very hard to capture. And I think they do a pretty good job. I mean, it doesn't hurt that he's already kind of acting crazy to begin with.
Right.
But a lot of the ways it's filmed, I think it was a smart choice to make almost all the overtly supernatural elements happen to Jack, who is an unreliable narrator, except for when the door is unlocked and he gets out of the pantry. Mm-hmm. You could argue that the ghosts are all in his head and that yeah. Danny did strangle himself. And then when Wendy sees in the book that weird guy in the dog suit, he's the gay lover of that man. I think it's kind of cool they don't go into that in the movie. So you just see some weird guy in a dog suit.
Wendy sees it
and is like, what the fuck? But also, that could easily be psychological too. So I think that they do a cool interplay of like, is this supernatural or is it really just like, or is he really going crazy? And are they coming apart at the seams? Which the answer I think is yes to both.
Yes. I feel like in the movie, one of the big differences between the movie and the book mm-hmm. is the book makes it very, very, very clear that the hotel is using Jack to get Danny.
Mm-hmm.
Because Danny's shining makes the people in the hotel stronger, more physical. I feel like, mm-hmm. and they feel like if they can kill Danny, they can get all of his shine.
Mm-hmm.
And to such an extent where I feel like in the book, if they had succeeded, if Jack had killed Danny, then by the mm-hmm. time May rolled around and people were coming back to the hotel, they would have come back to a hotel filled with people,
mm-hmm.
seemingly to them. It would have been like, all these ghosts are now people again. That's what it felt like to be reading the book. Whereas in the movie, it feels like the hotel is directly targeting Jack because it wants Jack because Jack was the caretaker.
Mm-hmm. You've always been the caretaker.
I think that something similar in the book happens, but I feel like it's undercut by so much talk of we need Danny.
In the book, maybe he's more of Tom.
Yeah, there's even a scene
in the movie,
where
he's more of the object.
In the book, there's even a scene where after Wendy knocks out Jack and puts him in the cupboard, where they're like, huh, your wife is stronger than we thought. Maybe we should just use her to get to Danny. And he's like, whoa, 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 no, you want me. You want me to do it because I'm going to be the one to do it. And they're like, I don't know, maybe we can just get your wife to do it. So it's like he's clearly just being used in the book. Whereas in the movie, he seems to be the object.
No, I agree with, and then I also think because in the movie, there's that that ambiguity of like his picture is in that photo from like mm-hmm. that 1920s party, and like so the idea that is he reincarnated mm-hmm. or is now that he's dead he in the picture. I mean, Stanley Kubrick's answered those questions, but he's notoriously known for like trying to mess with people. So he said that yes, like he's essentially like always been the caretaker, yeah. and that he was in that picture, right? Blah blah blah. But you know, I like to subscribe to like the author is dead philosophy, where it's like you can kind of draw your own conclusions based on what happens and what you yeah. like, you know. I don't think
the Shining, I feel like
the author should tell you what it is.
The Shining, I feel like, is to a certain extent intentionally ambiguous.
Yes.
I think there's a lot of fan theories about The Shining, the movie.
Uh-oh.
And I've read through a bunch of them. I agree with not a lot of them, but there's a lot to be said about how a movie can survive, not by being given answers, but just given questions.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the biggest thing going for The Shining, the movie, is just how ambiguous it is. Because one thing I think is so funny is there's a lot of questions, a lot of fan theories that you would easily be able to answer if you also just read the book.
Yeah.
Like a lot of them are like, oh, it's about how we treated Native Americans, because there's that scene where Jack is getting drinks from Lloyd and he says, you know, white man's burden, and it's on an Indian burial ground, and there's all this mm-hmm. architecture of Native Americans. It's like, why does he say white man's burden? And it's like, because he says it in the book, guys. He just adapted that scene, like word for word.
Same with the guy in the dog suit. I've read a lot of people like, oh, like what? That was so random. It was so weird. Like, who was that? And I'm like, a cursory Google search could tell you.
Yes.
And that's, again, a direct pickup from the book. And also yeah, that, like a lot of those things don't need, because it's like more, it's atmospheric, you yes. know? There is an explanation, but in order to get into, it's not like, oh, wow, you really need to know what the meaning of this is to get yeah. it. It's like Jack being a dick, not really, I mean, he just kind of is.
Yeah, that's why I think it's so funny. It's like, oh yeah, what was the purpose of the dog person? It was in the book, so you adapt what's in the book.
Yeah.
It's very clear. That's what I think is so funny about The Shining, that there was even a documentary called Room 237, which I have not seen, but I've heard it's mm-hmm. insane. I heard it's absolutely crazy.
Ooh, what?
It's just full of like all these crazy fan theories, and like half of them disprove the other half or something. It's just like, calm down, guys. like I said, that scene with Lloyd, which I think is one of the best scenes in the entire movie, where he first meets Lloyd and the hotel is miraculously stored with alcohol. Mm-hmm. That scene is almost line for line out of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big scene where people get all of their fan theories. So it's like, what is he saying? Why aren't you asking Stephen King instead? Because he's the one who wrote it. He's probably more apt to talk than Kubrick was when he was around.
Definitely. Stephen King, I love him. He's
great.
And just like the fact that he's got just so incredibly talented, and he's just built these very intricate worlds and so many of them.
Oh, yeah.
It just really like blows your mind.
Stephen King is absolutely fantastic. The biggest change, which of course Stephen King has said several times he's not a fan of, is that it seems that Jack Torrance is crazy when he gets there, as opposed to being driven crazy by alcohol and the spirits of the Overlook. And the biggest indicator by far is when Wendy finally gets to read Jack's manuscript, which is just ream after ream of all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy, which such a creepy scene, such a great reveal.
It is.
The music is incredible at that moment. But for that to make sense, that means the second we see Jack Torrance typing at all in the movie, he's already crazy.
Yep.
Which means he's crazy from like 30 minutes into the movie. Mm-hmm. Like that scene very early on where he tells Wendy to get out of there, and whenever you hear me typing, that means I'm working, so you're breaking my concentration. He's crazy. He's just typing all work and no play and make Shaggy Dog Boy then, probably.
Yeah, you're probably right. You're definitely right. I also like that implication that he's been crazy all along, because obviously, again, being a book dick, but it's a huge departure from the book, but in a good way, because it's not like, because it's a reveal, but it's not like a he was dead all along reveal where you're like, wow, does that really make sense? And then you're like, actually kind of doesn't make sense. This one's like, oh, that actually makes sense. Like,
yeah, it's a self-contained plot twist, where a lot of times, I spoke about this with Sean on an episode once, where it's like most plot twists, you go, whoa, that makes this make sense. But wait a minute, now this other stuff I was supposed to believe doesn't make sense anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Now this, that's what you told me to believe is not true. That, wait, now everything's kind of crumbling in on itself.
Mm-hmm.
And not too long after we see that scene where he first is typing, we do see the scene where he's like looking at the top of his eyes and looking like absolutely crazy, watching Danny and Wendy frolic in the snow. So he's gone at that point.
Yeah,
it does make sense.
It does.
The craziest thing about that scene too is just looking at the pages, because there's so many typos in there too.
And he really switches up the presentation.
My favorite pages of that are the ones where it's not just the line over and over again, where it's like formatted like paragraphs and like a little inside paragraph and dialogue paragraphs, where it felt like he was writing a book, but all he was writing was just the same phrase over and over again. Because apparently Kubrick was crazy. Because, Kubrick was crazy. So he had a secretary actually type out all those pages. It wasn't like photocopy or anything. It was typed out so she messed up sometimes.
Yeah.
So there are scenes where something should be capitalized and it's not, or it's missing a letter because someone typed through like 500 pages of that.
Honestly, if someone paid me to do that, I'd do it. And then I'd be like, I was in The Shining.
Well, yeah, if Stanley Kubrick was like, type this out, you'll be in The Shining, I'll be like, okay, sir. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
But
right away, sir.
It is funny to me that it's a movie about going crazy, and he probably drove at least two people crazy. Yeah. Shelley Duvall and that secretary.
I think he probably drove quite a few people crazy in his day.
Probably.
Those, whatever you call it, insufferable genius types.
Which that leads to another great scene where Jack basically reveals he's crazy to Wendy, where she has the bat, the give me the bat scene, which is also fantastically done in The Shining, the Simpsons Trios of Horror skit.
Mm-hmm. What do you got? Like, darling, light of my life, I'm not going to hurt you. I'm just going to bash your fucking brains in. In the scene where he's coming after Wendy and he hacks down the bathroom door, Jack Nicholson was a volunteer fireman. So
yeah, I read that.
So he hacked down the door like so fast, they had to build a bigger, better door. So it would take longer.
Yeah, I heard they initially were just going to do like a fake door. And he like chopped it down in like two strikes because he was a volunteer firefighter. So they're like, okay, so let's get a real door for him because he's too good, apparently.
He's got power.
One thing I liked about Stanley Kubrick's craziness in that scene is, he did a million takes of that. And there's only a handful of shots where I can tell that the door was chopped down in a different way. Like there is one scene after he gets sliced with the knife where you see that the panel next to the one he said, here's Johnny in, has also mm-hmm. been chopped down, which never happened in the movie, mm-hmm. which never happened before. But that's like the one time where I'm like, oh, it looks like that's a different take.
Yeah, so he's pretty good at keeping it pretty consistent.
Continuity editing, for sure.
I think the smart thing he does, too, is to lend the creepiness. They moved things around, furniture and stuff like that, which is also good because in all that filming, you're going to mess things up probably mm-hmm. and have to go back in post-production or be really careful when you're filming. So it's almost easier if you're mm-hmm. already intentionally moving things around, because then right. if like a water glass moves or something moves or a chair moves or whatever, then oh, it's the ghost.
Yeah, there's a few things on IMDb where they're like, here's a goof. At one point this chair was there, and then when they cut back it's not there. That's a goof. I'm like, no, it's probably intentional, honestly. Yeah,
I would guess that's intentional.
One quick thing I do want to throw in, more IMDb trivia, because that's always fun.
Mm-hmm. Straight.
The actor Slim Pickens, who was in Doctor Strangelove, which is a great movie, great movie. He was going to play Halloran. That's what Kubrick wanted, which is interesting because Slim Pickens, I believe, is a white man, and that would have been something. So he wanted him to play Dick Halloran, mm-hmm. but Slim Pickens, after being with him on Doctor Strangelove, wanted nothing to do with it. He's like, I don't want to be in another Kubrick movie.
Yeah, it sounds like it's hell on earth. Worth it, but what is it not?
Scatman Crothers, who did play Dick Halloran, his next movie was a Clint Eastwood movie, and he went to the ground and cried after one of the takes, because Clint Eastwood is a one and done kind of guy. So there was one scene where he did a take and Clint Eastwood's like, okay, we're done, and Scatman Crothers was like, seriously, we're done? I have to do it again? After, you know, working with Kubrick, where he did something like 150 times or whatever, mm-hmm. he was just like, oh my god, this is so great, I'm so happy. This movie did take like a year to make, apparently.
I was reading, it was saying like most of Jack Nicholson's takes were in the 20s. Mm-hmm. So the takes they used, I mean, I think they did more than that.
Yeah.
Which is, oh God. But like most of the takes they chose were in the 20s. So he'd be like so exhausted, but also really amping it up, you know, yeah. like, to get it over with.
That's like when he hit his like second wind, I guess.
I would be interested to see a movie like with different takes, you know?
Yeah. You could easily make probably a version of this movie that's much more subdued out of like the first handful of takes for all of them.
Mm-hmm.
No, you could probably make a version of The Shining that Stephen King would love just out of the alternate takes.
That'd be kind of cool.
Yeah, that'd be great. If someone found like the raw footage or whatever, and they're like, we cut together like the most subdued Jack takes and the mm-hmm. most empowered Wendy takes or whatever. And they're like, guess what? We found a new version of The Shining somehow.
It is interesting to think about all the stuff that ends up on the cutting room floor that no one really sees.
Oh, yeah. Apparently there was an alternate ending to the movie, which would have made no sense at all, where they're in the hospital after they have escaped the Overlook and Jack froze to death, where they're like, your husband's body is missing. We can't find it. It's like, it's the most cliche hook for a sequel scene I've ever heard. It's like, how? He was outside in like 10 degree weather, snowing. He's clearly dead. Let's just move on.
Yeah, he's frozen. He's dead.
He's dead. Which maybe, I don't know, maybe the hotel absorbed him or something and now he's in the picture. I don't know. Maybe it's like Harry Potter rules where he's like now part of the picture. I don't know.
These are questions that we just can't answer.
Nope.
Answers we'll never have.
Nope. And unlike most crazy fans of The Shining, I'm okay with that. I'm totally fine with that. Some movies are ambiguous enough where like, okay, there's a certain point where I hit and I'm like, you're trying to be ambiguous, so I'm going to turn my brain off a little bit and not worry about it.
Totally agree. Because I like a little ambiguity. I don't like when things are spoon-fed to you 100%. Like, I recently mm-hmm. got into this show called Dark on Netflix. It's German.
Yep.
And I watched the whole season. It's like, you have to pay really close attention, first of all, because it's not in English. And second of all, because they don't spoon feed you anything. You just you kind of realize how, oh, wow, we're so used to like being led to water and then like given a straw, essentially.
Yeah, pretty much.
And it's just like, it's not very genuine. So I like it better.
There's a lot of foreign films I feel like that are like that, where it's just like, we're going to show you some really creepy stuff and maybe it'll make sense.
Mm-hmm. You know, maybe like, it will, maybe it won't. Who's to say?
Who cares? We'll find out somehow. It's like, okay, well, I'm with you. Some really good foreign films. One of the things we touched upon earlier, which I do want to talk about before we wrap up this episode, is Dick Halloran at the end. Because in the book, I think he is a much more vivid character. And I think...
Yes. So true.
And I think it's almost comical what they do to him.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's in Florida, just like kind of watching the news, which the Florida news randomly decides to talk about a Colorado blizzard. I don't think that would ever happen in real life.
Right.
Unless they were getting like the snow of the millennium. Mm-hmm. If they were like, Colorado is buried under 28 feet of snow, then they might talk about it for 5 minutes. And Danny reaches out with The Shining. He's, you know, he calls out to Dick.
Mm-hmm.
So Dick, he gets on a plane right away. He rents a car. He drives through the awful Colorado snowy conditions. He gets a snow cat, drives up through unplowed streets covered in like 20 feet of snow, gets to the hotel, goes inside the hotel, says hello, and gets killed instantly by Jack with an axe. That was bordering on a slapstick death.
It was like a freaking cartoon.
Yeah, he spent like the last 18 hours of his life on a mission to get to this one place, and he dies 12 seconds later.
And again, being that not in the book, Dick, but it's not in the book, and why the hell did they make it happen like that? It's not satisfying like on a narrative level. It doesn't make sense. It's just like useless.
I feel like it's one of those things where, since they changed, another big change from the book to the movie is that Jack Torrance doesn't use a mallet, a croquet mallet, but it's just bigger. He uses an axe. In the book, in the miniseries, you can get cracked with a roque mallet and survive.
Mm-hmm.
You won't be in great shape. You can, like, in the book, he has like broken bones and broken teeth, and they're all messed up afterwards. But you can't take an axe to the chest and or an axe almost anywhere and live.
Yep.
So it's like that change kind of almost like seems like it forced their hands.
I feel like they could have just been more clever about it.
Give him like an extended scene, and maybe gets like chopped in the arm or something, and he thinks he's dead, but he's not. I don't know.
Or he knocks the axe out, and then he gets it with something else that gives like Wendy time to run away, and then he gets the axe to run after Wendy and like leaves that guy just with his ass beat.
Yeah, it could have been like the mallet, and he like broke the mallet on Dick Halloran.
Yeah,
and then he had to like.
Options. I feel like they just took a really lazy route. They probably just didn't really want to deal. They probably just wanted to focus on Danny and Wendy.
Yeah, there's certain horror movies where it's like we really only know how to handle a handful of characters in the situation, and you'll sometimes find a situation where there's like, we can handle three characters, but we have five. And like, there's 30 minutes left. Mm-hmm. So we're going to drop two really quick.
Yep.
And that's what Dick felt like. Dick coming into this movie is kind of throwing off the balance of what we got going on here. Mm-hmm. So let's just acknowledge he showed up.
We got a tricycle going. We don't want a quad.
Right. You want to hear, this is what I think is the most nuts fact that I read, because I thought it was absolutely insane. So Stanley Kubrick's original treatment that he wrote like really quickly when he realized he was going to be writing The Shining.
Mm-hmm.
The original treatment that I read about, they kill Jack Torrance, like Wendy and Dick Halloran, mm-hmm. and Danny. Like when Dick gets there, they kill him with like a knife or something. And then the hotel like instantly goes after Dick Halloran and like possesses him to kill Danny, and then they have to kill and escape Dick Halloran instead.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like,
which actually, that makes a little bit, because in the book, the hotel does try to get Dick Halloran to do it after Jack's dead.
Yeah, very quickly, but it's just like, here's the thought. He's like, no, we're out of here.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that's such a crazy first draft of this story.
It is.
To be like, all right, I think we're going to kill our villain like 2/3 way through the movie, and then add Dick Halloran as the actual villain now. It's like, what?
Mm-hmm. I'm glad they didn't do that. But I almost wish they did, because at least then they would have done something with the Dick Halloran character.
Yeah. We will end this on two separate questions.
Okay.
So the ending of the movie, after Danny has outsmarted Jack in the hedge maze, in a great scene where he retraces his steps and Jack goes nuts. He literally like runs past the empty steps and freezes to death, overlooking the hotel. But we get this weird scene after they escape where they zoom in on an old photograph dated July 4th, 1921, with Jack Torrance smiling front center. What is your interpretation of that picture? Was it always there? Did they like pass by like a million times while they were working there? Or is that symbolic of the hotel absorbing Jack?
I think those are both pretty valid interpretations. When I first saw it, I thought that the hotel had absorbed Jack. That's what was my thought. Though, to be honest, when I was a kid, I read a lot of Roald Dahl books, and one of them was The Witches.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that one of the witches did was trap a little girl in a painting. And I saw The Shining when I was probably arguably too young. So I thought that, but it could also be linked to what I had read in the Witches. But I also think it's a valid interpretation, that especially with like the repeating of the line, like,
like, oh, you were always the, you've always been the caretaker. You were
always the caretaker.
Exactly. Precisely. Very, and good accent as well. So I think that it's hard for me. That's what, same with the book versus the movie. It's hard for me to pick which one's my favorite because I think both make sense in a certain way. But
you better decide soon, because that's the second question.
What's that?
I said, you better decide, because that's the second question.
Wow. Well, look at me. I got The Shining. Wow. I guess if I'm talking, I mean, and you can't really talk logical because it's a horror movie and it's a Kubrick movie, but talking logically, if he's like a reincarnation or whatever, it's only been like 60 years. So that doesn't seem all that likely.
Right.
I could see that happening over like a few hundred years, but like, well, he's in his 40s, definitely.
Yeah.
So what, 10, 15 years pass and then he gets reincarnated. Like, I don't know if if that would stand up, but all of this is just completely nebulous anyway.
You know what's funny? I was going to say, I think it's always been there, and I think it's a reincarnation kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But you saying that it's only been 60 years,
mm-hmm.
almost, it might actually change my mind, because I have, this is not a Shining theory, it's not a horror theory. This is a very bizarre life theory that I'm not sure even I believe. I just came up with it one day.
Yeah, go for it.
I thought it'd be interesting if reincarnation is real, and just like every action is an equal and opposite reaction. I said, what if life and death are the same? Mm-hmm. So if you live 61 years, you're going to be mm-hmm. dead for 61 years and then are reincarnated.
Mm-hmm.
Like if they're equal and balancing acts between.
Yeah, I can see that.
I think that makes sense to me in my scientific brain or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes me think maybe he is being absorbed into the hotel and it wasn't always there for them to see at any time.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'll say, I guess. And the second question, Megan, Shining book or movie, what's your pick?
I've been cheating with every question by giving two answers. So this one, I'm not going to cheat and I'm going to go with movie. And I will tell you why, because I love the book, but the movie is probably one of my favorite movies.
Mm-hmm.
And the book is not even my top five favorite Stephen King books. So I guess it's hard for me to actually pick because I love them both. But just in terms of my like passion interest, I've watched the movie far more often than I've read the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the weirdness, a lot of the weirdness that understandably Stephen King doesn't like, because it kind of subverts his overall message in the movie, which is like, right. You know, the common man being felled by, you know, alcoholism and then all these other things. I feel like the message that The Shining tells is one that is not often told. It's like the whole like crazy man going crazier. And also his wife in the book, the wife, again, like pretty typical, like blonde haired, pretty. Mm-hmm. Again, I like her, but in the movie, she's not really that likable. And she also, she doesn't have like a kick-ass like Uma Thurman moment. There's nothing like that. She's more like kind of like a mousy, desperate, traumatized woman just trying to survive. And I find there's something more engaging in that.
Something like a little bit more relatable, because it's like the things that are scary in the book, in the movie, wouldn't be as scary if she was like, I got this.
Exactly. It's like, even look, if her marriage with Jack was better, even. He's the one who's going crazy, but she's just as isolated.
Yeah. In every horror movie, you do want a, you know, a strong character, but you also do want a character who has realistic, or, you know, is very scarable to actually like play up the scares you're trying to get. Mm-hmm. And the fewer characters you get, the more you have to choose which one you want. I agree with a lot of what you said. I don't have The Shining, the book, in my top five King either. Like I told you before the show, I think I actually might slightly prefer Dr. Sleep to The Shining. I think the characters are so much more rich. I mean, there's more characters that are really in depth, and there's more likable characters in Dr. Sleep. Like I really got into Danny's great, Abra's great, the doctor. It almost feels like Salem's Lot to me. Like the group dynamic of Dr. Sleep is similar to Salem's Lot, which I really like too.
That just looks with a
shining
ensemble.
Yeah, with just a shining like coat over top of it. The book, I don't think is one of my top favorites. I give the movie a slight edge, but what's weird to me is what I don't like about the book, I mean the movie, is how different it is from the book.
Mm-hmm.
But the book's not one of my Stephen King favorites, so it's like a weird dichotomy thing going on here.
Well, you know, we keep talking and just saying like, oh, like it wasn't like that in the book. The book looked better, but like when it comes down to it, I mean, doesn't necessarily...
Right, it's like, well, that's not like in the book, but it was great in the movie. Well, yeah, but it wasn't like that in the book. It's like I'm talking out both sides of my mouth when I talk about The Shining. So I'm like,
I feel great. The exact same way.
It's like, this is great, but it's not what it's supposed to be. But it's great, but it's not what it's supposed to be. So I'll give slight edge for me. They really are two separate things, even though there are scenes from the movie that are just ripped out of the book. Characters are obviously, you know, the same name, same locations, a lot of the same ghosts, adversaries they come up against, but they're just so different. It's hard to just to directly compare the two.
And whenever you start talking about one, you start talking about the other. Right. And then comparisons are made, but whether or not you make them like a positive or negative comparison. But then when it comes down to it, they're both just really excellent on their own.
It's standing. Like, I'm gonna make a weird analogy. It's like chocolate and peanut butter. Like, a lot of times you think of one, then you think of the other, but you can't compare chocolate and peanut butter. Like, how would you compare and contrast chocolate and peanut butter? But you, in your head, you connect the two.
Mm-hmm.
It's like that, I guess. And The Shining, the movie, is definitely chocolate for sure. It wins.
Yeah, I would agree. I'm glad we concur on that one.
We're on the same.
Now I kind of want to reread the Shining, but again, the take that Stanley Kubrick took, and I am really fascinated by how he completely subverted the expectation of like the, oh, you have a classically good looking married young couple, and you're going to age them up, and you're going to make them less attractive, and you're going to make them less likable, intentional.
And you're going to take the emphasis off of the kid character that we ideally want to see succeed and put it on the crazy person who is trying to kill his family.
Mm-hmm.
That's a weird choice. There's so many different like what ifs. That's the most fascinating part to me, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
About The Shining is thinking about, like we said earlier, what if Christopher Reeve was Jack Torrance? That's really interesting.
It is.
What if you would replace all the cuts Kubrick picked with other takes that were less subdued? That's interesting. It's like,
it is.
The movie itself is great, but it's just opened itself to all these possibilities that I don't feel the same way about the book, where I'm like, oh, what if King did this? It's just like, the book kind of is what it is, and it's good, but I don't think it's King's best.
No, I was reading a review for a Doctor Sleep that it showed how Stephen King's writing has improved a lot over the years.
Yeah,
which I mean, I'd have to read them side by side to say for sure. But Stephen King, just as a person, has like grown and changed a lot, so it makes sense that his writing also evolved.
Yeah, I did read them more or less side by side. I read them like one after another, and the biggest difference in his writing style, I feel like his character work in Doctor Sleep is a little bit better than The Shining, but I feel like the big thing he lost along the way was the abject horror.
Mm-hmm.
He's not as big on a force of evil as opposed to like almost relatable
villains
with human qualities to them, like the True Knot in Dr. Sleep. They're kind of pathetic in some scenes where they're just
they're
not that horrifying. It's almost like the good guys are just beating up on the True Knot sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, that's relatable, but it's also not as scary, but it's also written, I think, better.
I feel like a lot of times, like, there's so much coincidence in fiction. Mm-hmm. Where it's like, oh, I'm either at my strongest or building towards that, and then coming up against an adversary that's of equal strength.
Yeah.
Whereas this, it's like the True Knot's heyday was it's been long past. Like, the nomadic culture is diminished.
Right.
And just the way things are now, they can't survive the way they used to. So they're already scrambling and they're already at a disadvantage.
Yeah.
Which I kind of like, because like, how often in life, you know, when you come up against something, are you really like equals?
Right. I will say, I would like to see like a new book where it is Stephen King's current work on characters and prose and all this other stuff against some kind of abject horror, like a Pennywise or like a Pet Sematary style.
I'm hoping that he does a follow-up to it. I know it's already been 27 years since the first time, but I mean, Pennywise is still alive. That's been established. Right. Pennywise lives. I would love if he did a follow-up to that.
You know what I would love to see, and it would have to be a collaboration with his son, Joe Hill. So Charlie Manx in Nosferatu, he abducts kids who their parents are terrible to them, who their parents mistreat them, and he brings them to Christmas Land.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to see an alternate universe take where Charlie Manx abducts Danny Torrance.
Interesting.
I think that would be so interesting, because that is the situation.
What does it do to the kids?
He brings them to Christmas Land, and he brings them in his 1928 Rolls Royce Wraith, gorgeous car, but it's like, in that world, there's these things called inscapes, which you can tap into a power, but it costs something.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a character who, she can tell the future, or she can tell stuff by going into a bag of Scrabble tiles. But the more she does it, the worse her stutter gets.
Mm-hmm.
Vic McQueen, the main character, can find lost things by crossing a bridge in her mind, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
But it kind of damages her psyche, damages her mind.
Mm-hmm.
Charlie Manx, what he does is he can take his car to Christmas Land, a world of lovely imagination, but it takes away his negative emotions.
Mm-hmm.
But since he's out of them, he has to use kids to go to Christmas Land now. So by the time they get to Christmas Land, these kids have been drained of all, like, they're like almost like perpetually innocent, but that's also a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because innocent kids will rip the wings off a fly and then, you know, have no feelings. So he basically turns these kids into more or less vampires. and he's essentially a vampire, like sucking their emotions out, their positive, their negative emotions out of them.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
So it's like, I would have liked to see him up against like a kid with powers that wasn't addressed in Nosferatu.
Mm-hmm.
And it can't be in the future because he's dead. So we have to go in the past and have that crossover. That would be so cool.
That would be interesting.
I would definitely recommend Nosferatu though. It's great.
Okay. No, I'll read it.
So we've settled the argument, guys. Book or movie, it's the movie by a hair for me and a little bit more than a hair for Megan. So Megan, thank you for spending some of your Valentine's Day with me and
you're very welcome.
The podcast and for those listening, thank you for spending whatever day you're listening to this with us. We greatly appreciate it. If you want to interact with the show, if you want to give me ideas for future episodes, email me at professionalhorror@gmail.com. Follow me on Instagram at professionalhorror or on Twitter at prohorrorcast. And until next time, stay scary, but keep it professional.
Godspeed.
Cool. Keep watching the skies.